Welcome to the Interpreter Foundation podcast. I'm Martin Tanner, co-hosting with Hale Swift and BYU Idaho professor Brent Schmidt. Our discussion topic for this podcast is the restored gospel, freedom, and government. Before we begin, we want you to know the Interpreter Foundation supports the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints through scholarship. We make the latest and best scholarship available to you in podcasts, radio shows, journals, books, seminars, films, and scripture roundtables. Please check out everything Interpreter has to offer at interpreterfoundation.org. If you like this show, please tell your friends about it and consider giving us a 5-star review. You can subscribe to Interpreter Podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, Libsyn, and all the other best and greatest podcast apps. Because Interpreter Foundation is not owned or controlled by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the comments we make are solely our own responsibility. And now on to our discussion topic, the restored gospel, freedom, and government. I wanted to start us off, first of all, by saying that freedom here in this country and in religion everywhere is a very important thing. And one of the foundational principles that in our church we believe in is freedom. That's what the war in heaven was all about. Were people going to be forced to do things, or were they going to be free to make choices, even bad ones, on their own? And so this is a foundational principle. It interacts closely with the gospel, and it also interacts very closely with the Constitution and the form of government that we have in this country. With that short little introduction, Professor Brent.
In all dispensations, there have been sometimes periods where the church and the government have worked well together or haven't worked well together. And we read in the Old Testament that sometimes kings support or sometimes kings do not support and persecute prophets in the Old Testament. And we know too that the Romans also were afraid in many ways of too much religious freedom. As long as people would give their pinch of salt to the Roman emperor, the Romans sometimes would let people have some degree of religious freedom. Eventually, though, the zealots in Jesus's time are going to clash with the Roman government, and the Roman government's going to, the emperor Titus and Vespasian are going to destroy the temple. Paul also, because he has Roman citizenship, he's able to travel, and he writes a little bit about church and state. He says that every soul should be, this is in Romans 13, verse 1, should be subject to the higher powers. And he says that there is no power but of God. So ultimately, power comes from God. And later in the 17th century, a lot of people, we know that King James sometimes and others, the Sun King in France, they sometimes took this too far to argue that everything they did was ordained of God. But we do have this principle that the powers that be are ordained of God. We find that in Paul's writings. And if you resist the power, in a lot of ways, you're resisting the ordinance or the authority of God. And it says here that the rulers are the ministers, verse 4, of God. And if you're doing evil, you should be afraid. And the ruler doesn't bear the sword in vain, but he will execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. And so we have later during the Enlightenment period, we're really blessed that we have these righteous men that the Lord raised up in section 101, verse 80, that have these really good principles. And people no longer after, beginning with the Enlightenment afterward, with a few exceptions like the French Revolution and others. Generally, in the West, we've had this idea of no one can take away your life, liberty, or property without the without going through and be adjudicated by law. And so, anyway, we're very blessed, I think, because of a lot of these principles. And the Lord is going to explain a little bit more to the prophet Joseph Smith. The prophet Joseph Smith is going to explain to the public through the articles of faith, we believe in being subject to kings, presidents, rulers, and magistrates, and obeying, honoring, sustaining the law. And I'll maybe in a little while I'll share a little bit more about some of the revelations that the prophet Joseph Smith received about government and agency.
Thank you. The section that Brent just referred to is Doctrine and Covenants section 101, verse 80, in which the Lord says, quote, "I establish the constitution of this land by the hand of wise men who I raised up unto this very purpose," close quote. Because of that, we as Latter-day Saints have this special connection with the idea that the constitutional law of the land is something that's very precious and that it's divinely ordained. More than that, and I'm sure Brent will have more to say about this later, more or less than the constitutional law is not always so great. It's interesting and often, excuse me, overlooked that the founding fathers were actually inspired by the Bible to come up with the three branches of government. Isaiah chapter 33, verse 22 describes how God perfectly governs his people in three essential ways: the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. It actually says that God is our king, God is our lawgiver, and God is our judge. Verse Isaiah 33:22 verbatim says, quote, "For the Lord is our judge, the Lord is our lawgiver, the Lord is our king, he will save us," close quote. So as the founding fathers read through that, they thought, well, these are the three appropriate branches of government, the executive, the legislative, and the judicial, and none of them should have priority over the other. We want checks and balances, so each one of these can be a check and a balance on the other. So the very ideas and concepts of our government are biblical. Another, go ahead.
There are also during the Enlightenment period in which the founding fathers were raised and educated, I think in the Romans and Greeks, they also have these beautiful ideas of separation of powers. You also have in first with Sparta, you have instead of having one king, you have two kings, and then you have in Rome, the Roman period, you'll have two consuls. And so the founding fathers, they wanted kind of two people ruling, but not a king. And so you have a president and a vice president, right? And then I think some of these other Greek and Roman cultures that are also used as models for many Enlightenment thinkers, they seem to also been inspired by God, I believe, that they found some of the best ideas from the Achaean League, which is an idea of federalism that you find in ancient Greece, kind of a later period of ancient Greece. The Romans have also a legislative branch with kind of different groups within that. And then you have your assemblies, some of your different court. You have your court system that starts really with Athens. So it seems that the Lord inspired not only his prophet Isaiah, but some of these other Western cultures to embrace some of these good principles that inspired James Madison, especially He's going to use a lot of the words like in Latin, an old person, the word senes in Latin is we get the word senate. These older wise men that will help be in many ways the part of the legislative group.
Wonderful. One of the comments that's often made about the United States is that we are a country that has, by nature, by its very founding, a complete separation of church and state. And that's actually not true. There are a few U.S. Supreme Court decisions that make it more true now than it was intended by the founding fathers. But the founding fathers in this wanted to separate church from state only in one sense, and that is they did not want a state-sponsored denomination. And we know that by looking at each one of the drafts of the First Amendment, which I've done. And it's very clear if you do that, that what was being done there was to make sure that there would be no law that was enacted by Congress that would create a state-sponsored denomination. They didn't want a Church of England here. And that was a way to have religious freedom. It was believed by the founding fathers. And the way that we know that they did not intend more than just having a denomination detachment from the government is the very day that the First Amendment was enacted. They also provided, they passed a law that opened and closed each session of Congress with a prayer. And that would never have happened if the idea was to completely keep religion out of government. Another way that
No.
we know that is from a number of the founding fathers' statements that shows that they very much wanted religion and non-denominational Christianity in education. Brent, you had a comment.
Yeah, and two, even if you look at the some of these earlier models of Western government, the Greeks actually even start their democratic proceedings in Athens with prayers as well. If you study a lot about how Athenians pray, they raise both hands up high in the air actually when they pray, and they have a sacrifice, and they ask the gods to bless their endeavors, bless them as they're praying. The Romans also would start with prayers as well. And so to say that all religion is shouldn't have anything to do with the government is really, really silly when you look at the tradition of our government.
That's something that even in the United States is actually a pretty recent origin. There were no U.S. Supreme Court decisions until the 1960s that had that forceful detachment of religion and federal government. So, I thought I might highlight quickly a couple of things that would enhance that the idea there that we live in a Christian nation, at least in terms of principles. Everyone is welcome, but the country is founded upon Christian principles. One of the more interesting ways that we can take a look at this is by looking at Benjamin Franklin. He's one of the more famous founding fathers. He was part of the Constitutional Convention. And Benjamin Franklin made an appeal during the Constitutional Convention that said this, quote, I therefore beg leave to move that henceforth prayers imploring the assistance of heaven and its blessings on our deliberations be held every morning before we proceed to business. Close quote. He liked the idea of divine inspiration. That's not something that he would have said if he wanted some kind of separation between church and state. And he went even further, in some ways further than some people might be comfortable with today. He wanted the Bible as a textbook in the colony of Pennsylvania. And of course, he's ultimately the one that founded the institution that is now the University of Pennsylvania. And if he had had his way, one of the main textbooks even there would have been the Bible, and it was so used for quite a few years when it was initially founded.
Also, I know Benjamin Franklin and a lot of the founding fathers are interested in having birds as the symbol and of our country. And in European history, and even much before that, with the Greeks and Romans and Greek and Roman mythology, birds are messengers of the gods to help inspire people. I know the Romans in some of their prayers, they would watch how birds would fly even to try to get some kind of message from the gods. So whether I know Benjamin Franklin, I think, wanted the turkey to be the national bird, or
He
the
did,
eagle,
yeah. There he departs from the eagle idea, yes.
or the, I think in the owl and Harry Potter, it's kind of all the same idea at least,
Yes,
right?
yes, yes.
And so let me just share a little bit, section 98. So he says here that about the laws of the land, section 98, verse 5. And the law of the land, which is constitutional, supporting that principle of freedom and maintaining rights and privileges, belongs to all mankind. So the Constitution helps us to have freedom and rights and privileges. And he says, and is justified before me. And he says, therefore, I, the Lord, justify you and your brethren of my church in befriending the law that is constitutional law of the land. So he wants us to befriend the law of the land. And he says, whatever, when we're talking about laws of men in verse 7, whatsoever is more or less than this cometh of evil. And he says, and I, the Lord, make you free, and you're free indeed, and the law also maketh you free. So Jesus teaches the same principle in the New Testament, where he says that we become free through following truth and his gospel. And he says here, nevertheless, when the wicked rule, the people mourn. So we should try to find honest and wise men. It says, diligently, good men, verse 10, that you should observe to uphold. And we're going to try to cleave to good. But ultimately, because of Jesus Christ and because of the principles that the founding fathers have brought to pass through the Constitution, we're very, very blessed that we have religious freedom. If you study some of the periods before in the Enlightenment, you see lots of times where the wicked reign and the people mourn. So we're very, very blessed to have constitutional government. Although there have been times where sometimes the government didn't respect, of course, the saints' rights in Missouri
Or in Utah.
or the Illinois governor just kind of let the assassination or the murder of Joseph Smith happen, right? So
One of the things you said reminded me of one of the bits I located from teachings of the prophet Joseph Smith. He says, "A man is saved no faster than he gets knowledge, for if he does not get knowledge, he will be brought into captivity by some evil power in the other world, as evil spirits will have more knowledge and consequently more power than many men who are on the earth. Hence, it needs revelation to assist us and give us knowledge of the things of God." There's a lot that goes into conferring and maintaining our agency as a critical part of our Heavenly Father's plan. It was so important that a third of the hosts of heaven turned away from God through agency, and it was still worth maintaining.
And given, if you will, what God has done in order to maintain our agency, I think we should be among the most vigilant in making sure that we are framing society in a way that also maintains our agency and allows the freedom of choose that allows people to develop and gain the knowledge and power that come from making right decisions, in contrast to the captivity and ignorance that comes from making wrong ones. On the In keeping with the theme of agency generally, it's a critical part of what we came to Earth to do and to become. Joseph Smith, Teachings of the Prophet Joseph Smith, page 185, has this: "We came to this earth that we might have a body and present it pure before God in the celestial kingdom. The great principle of happiness consists in having a body. The devil has no body, and herein is his punishment. He is pleased when he can obtain the tabernacle of man, and when cast out by the Savior, he asked to go into the herd of swine, showing that he would prefer the swine's body to having none. All beings who have bodies have power over those who have not. The devil has no power over us, only as we permit him. The moment we revolt at anything that which comes from God, the devil takes power." Together, it seems that we are given bodies in part to make us free. It's almost like you're being given your own personal castle as a guard on your agency. And if you only let that which is good and holy into then you can be free. If, on the other hand, you let the devil into it, you will be in some degree of captivity. And that's certainly the case with some of the vices that so trouble the world. If you partake of illicit drugs and so forth, you diminish your agency and scope of action. If, on the other hand, you submit yourself to the commandments of God and follow them diligently, you gain greater freedom and scope of action and opportunity for what actually amounts to the good life. But I guess the battle for agency happens on both individual and societal levels. And we are for the agency of man and its right use on all of those.
Perfect. Dovetailing into that is a quote from Thomas Jefferson, which everyone has heard before. Quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal and they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. Among those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness," close quote. So that is one of the unalienable rights that the founding fathers were so very anxious to maintain. If you wonder how it could possibly work, I was talking a little bit earlier about the idea that government should actually have religious content by way of prayers in Congress and other things. And the question is, well, how would that work? You know, what if someone were to say an overtly, Jewish prayer or Baptist prayer, why would somebody else have to be subject to that? Thomas Jefferson wrote a wonderful piece of legislation that was never passed legislatively and actually not federally and not even in the Virginia colony. It was called a Bill for Religious Freedom. And in it, the key principle was toleration. You don't have to like anybody else's religious points of view or their denomination. Just tolerate it. Just leave it alone. You don't have to like what the Mormons say or what the Baptists say or what the
You mean the
any other
letter?
denomination says. Yeah, just tolerate it. Just be okay with it, and that would work wonders. We somehow live in a world today where there's this idea that enshrined in the Constitution is the idea of you have the right to freedom from religion and free and from religious influences, and that was never the way it was intended. And Jefferson would never have given us the preamble to the Constitution in the way he gave it if that were intended.
The Constitution, we're handing out freedom from something. I think we maybe should write freedom from telemarketers into it. I think that would lead to a lot more life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness than anything else I can think of.
Well said, well said. Another quick comment about Jefferson. This is a sort of a slight diversion, but there are people who say, oh, that's all nonsense. Jefferson was not really a Christian. After all, take a look at the Jefferson Bible. It took out all of the miracles of Jesus. And if you say it that way, which is true, it sounds bad. But if you really understand what Jefferson had in mind, then it all makes sense. Jefferson thought that the words of Jesus were the most important words that had ever been spoken. And he thought the New Testament was all cluttered up with different comments from different people and different events. And so his Jefferson Bible is practically identical to the red letter Bibles that the Catholics have that have only the words of Jesus, or that have the words of Jesus highlighted in red. Jefferson's Bible wasn't meant to exclude miracles. It was just meant to focus on the actual words of Jesus, which he thought were absolutely sublime and amazing. So if you ever get a copy of the Jefferson Bible, that's what you'll get. It's an amazing Bible. Another
Maybe
comment. Go ahead.
Jefferson and there were a kind of a small group of people in the during the Enlightenment or the late 18th century that they were deists and they believed that God created the earth and that he kind of stepped away. And so they were unsure about some of the miracles because they wondered kind of how would science fit into that and everything. But I think a lot of people use that to undermine the fact that Jefferson really did believe in Jesus and good moral principles, and he liked religion actually. And I think he just had a lot of problems with some of the supernatural claims of the church in the Middle Ages, we might say that. Some of them are pretty preposterous.
Jefferson was fond of a lot of different denominations. And when the First Amendment was enacted that allowed for religious freedom, there was a lot of changes. I didn't bring with me today a list of which colony allowed which religion and which colony disallowed which religions, but there were several colonies where if you were a Catholic, you could not hold public office. If you were Jewish, you couldn't hold public office. If you were a Baptist, you couldn't hold public office. And so things were kind of a mess in the colonies. But once the First Amendment was enacted, it was a really good thing. And it was Thomas Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptist Association, which was pointing that out to the Danbury Baptists. He was saying, isn't it wonderful? You now have a First Amendment that has a wall of separation between church and state. And the wall that he was talking about was a wall so the government could not interfere with the Baptists and pass laws that would affect them, not a wall that would keep a Baptist prayer out of government, because that's just not what was intended.
And Joseph Smith has kind of the same concern that the Lord expresses in section 134, verse 9. And Joseph Smith, in this verse, it says, "We don't believe it just to mingle religious influence with civil government," which kind of sounds like a lot of modern people, but if you read what it's really saying, it says, "Whereby one religious society is fostered and another is prescribed," or basically targeted, we might say, in its spiritual privileges and the individual rights of its members as citizens denied. And so there was a lot of targeting of different religious groups. I know in Maryland, everybody was Catholic, but I think in most of the colonies, they didn't like Catholics, and especially Jewish people as well. And certain other Protestant groups didn't like others. There were some that were more Puritan and not, but that's one of the things the Lord doesn't like, is that people using religion or the state to foster or support different churches. And then it says here, verse 10, "We believe all religious societies have a right to deal with their members for disorderly conduct, but the churches can't take life or limb or inflict physical punishment." In the Middle Ages, the church and the state worked together. The church would try people and then just turn them over to the state for punishment. And so in a lot of ways, the restored church is correcting a lot of the abuses of the church of the Middle Ages.
One of the topics I wanted to touch on briefly, moving on to something that's related but very different, is the quote that we often hear. If you read the writings of Brigham Young or Orson Hyde or John Taylor or even Harold B. Lee and Melvin J. Ballard and probably many, many, many others, those are the ones that I can think of off the top of my head, who made the comment that Joseph Smith said that the time would come when the Constitution would hang by a thread.
Everyone's favorite
And I searched for years to find that quote, and there is no quote where Joseph Smith ever said the Constitution was hanging by a thread. But he said something very close to it, which is, in all likelihood, where all of those brethren got the idea, or perhaps he said it in a place and time where it just wasn't recorded. I mean, that's also possibly the source as well. But there's this delightful young lady who had joined the church when she was in her teens, and she was enamored by the church and the gospel and by Joseph Smith. And she was a great note taker, and she, without her, many of these statements and speeches of Joseph Smith would be lost. And Sister Corey, on July 19th of 1840, took notes for one of the speeches of Joseph Smith, and in it she had this quote. The very verge, well, the gist of it was that she said that Joseph Smith said in the future the United States would be brought to, quote, the very verge of crumbling to pieces and tumbling to the ground. And then when the Constitution is upon the brink of ruin, this people will be the staff upon which the nation shall lean, and they shall bear the Constitution away from the very verge of destruction. Close quote. You can also find that easily in the Joseph Smith papers. But that to me sounds just like the hanging by a thread comment, just using a different a different metaphor. Brink of ruin, hang by a thread. It's sort of the same idea. So Joseph Smith obviously believed that. One of the reasons that Brigham Young University established a law school was because the brethren felt very strongly that the church should have some good legal minds that would help this very thing happen, the Constitution would be saved. J. Reuben Clark, after whom the law school is named, was a lawyer, and he was very strong on the idea that the church should have good legal minds to try to save the Constitution. Well, that about wraps up the topics that we had hoped to cover for you. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. This has been Professor Brent Schmidt, Hales Swift, and I'm Martin Tanner. Join us again next time on our Interpreter Podcasts.